integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation.
Waiting to learn the fate of a Camp Lejeune colonel accused of sexually assaulting a child. It's now being decided by trial members. Colonel Daniel Wilson faces multiple sexual assault charges. They stem from alleged incidents in 2016. WNCT's Elizabeth Tu was in the courtroom today. She reports from base.
A very important day for Colonel Wilson. That's how his defense attorney described today's closing arguments after nearly 2 weeks of testimony. The government asked the trial members to consider possible motives of both accusers, one of whom is 6 years old. It described both of them as vulnerable. The defense team went next. Lawyer Philip Stackhouse asking the members to view the charges through a prism, taking the colonel's Article 133 charges in context, describing them as, quote, bad jokes. Stackhouse detailed a lack of DNA evidence pointing to Wilson, as well as the possibility that false memories were implanted in the young accuser's mind. He even raised the possibility of someone else committing the assault. As for the assault and battery charges made by the woman during her trip with the Wilsons to South Carolina, Stackhouse pointed to comments she made describing the multiple assaults as feeling, quote, like a dream. He pointed to the possibility she was hallucinating. The government then addressed the members one last time, reiterating how all accusations align with evidence. Members did begin their deliberations this afternoon. No word yet on when they will come back with a verdict. Aboard Camp Lejeune, Elizabeth Tu, 9 on your side. Camp Lejeune colonel was found guilty today of sexually abusing a child. We followed the accusations made against Colonel Daniel Wilson from the very beginning. And after 2 weeks of testimony and a day of deliberations, eight members found Colonel Wilson guilty on three charges. The first, sexually abusing a girl under 12. He was also found guilty on multiple Article 133 charges of conduct unbecoming an officer and guilty of absence without leave. On all other charges, including sexual assault and battery of a woman, he was found not guilty. Sentencing is expected tomorrow.
Welcome back to Military Justice. This is episode 27, and we'll be discussing a recent court-martial, Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, of a Marine colonel. I have two Daily Beast reporters on this episode, and I hope you enjoy their insights. One caveat, this episode is not for small ears. So, God Smalls, that is little baby James Lee, and Mary Elaine, you need to put earmuffs on, or maybe just go find a different podcast to listen to. But for everybody else, please enjoy this episode. Well, let's get started. Gentlemen, thank you for being here today. First, since you haven't been on before, Rory, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, yeah. My name is Rory Laverty. I am a professor at UNC Wilmington, actually a lecturer. I teach English, specifically journalism. And I write for the Daily Beast, covering military and crime stories. And the most recent one was Colonel Wilson and his court-martial.
And I'm guessing, James, since you are a Daily Beaster, you are the one that brought Rory along?
Yeah. It was for a couple of reasons. When the charges first were announced against Colonel Wilson in November, you know, I wasn't exactly – I was still debating on whether to cover the story or not. you know, and I didn't know because I had previously served under him. You know, I wasn't sure if I was too close to the story. And so I brought Rory in to get his thoughts, but also when I eventually decided to cover the story, I wanted someone to keep me in check in terms of my own, if I may have either, you know, any sort of biases, whether I be aware of those biases or not. So so that's eventually why I brought Rory in on, to kind of keep me in check and to make sure I wasn't favoring him in one way or the other.
Yeah, and at the outset, I'll ask Rory to kind of bring us up to speed on the case, but I will say that I've also had that happen in this case. A number of people I know, I mean, Colonel Wilson was in the Marine Corps for years and touched many, 30 years and touched many people's lives. So a number of people that I greatly respect, a lot of peers and colleagues, knew him and thought very highly of him. That being said, so Rory, can you kind of bring us up to speed on where we are?
Oh, well, I was just going to say, I mean, and we could address this later, but to speak to your comment about a lot of people liking him, we've gotten a little bit of criticism from people online about the story in terms of, you know, why we talked about his accolades and, you know, why we mentioned his, you know, what he did in his military career, you know, that we should have focused more on his discrepancies and, you know, what he did to, you know, the six-year-old and stuff like that. And what I tried to tell people was that's what made the whole case so shocking, is that it was his likability. It was this, he's got this very welcoming personality, you know, despite him being, you know, 6'4", 200 pounds, he has a way of just humbling himself. And he, it's almost, you wanted to give him this respect. You wanted to like him because of his years in service, both as a Marine officer and then prior to that as an enlisted Marine. But it was important to put those accolades in there to paint the entire picture of him. But we can go into that later. But
yeah, Rory, can you bring us up to speed? First of all, when was he convicted? And then we'll get on to the sentencing portion.
Okay, he was convicted, let's see. You have the date on that, James? It was 2 weeks ago.
I want to say
so
it was
around the second week of September.
Yes.
Yeah.
Would you like me to tell you a little bit about the case in general?
Please do.
Okay. Well, there's really three parts to this case, and they all came up in 2017, but they're really about the women and girls in Colonel Dan Wilson's orbit in 2016. So when this first started, the first charges that were filed were about a six-year-old girl and her two sisters, age 6 and 10, that Wilson was alleged to have abused sexually in a variety of ways, including stuff like giving them alcohol and sort of lesser offenses. After that, after those charges came out, there were more charges. Some of them were from earlier in 2016, relating to his time as a liaison officer in Darwin, Australia. Those were mostly conduct unbecoming charges. I believe he racked up about 8 of them in 10 days out of what was supposed to be a 6 to 8 month billet in Darwin. So the first part of the case is the girls and the sex abuse charges. The second part was this Darwin, Australia conduct unbecoming charges. And the third part was after he was charged, he was not detained. He was not incarcerated in the brig. And in the 2 months there, he was alleged by Jerry Walsh to have raped her, to have sexually assaulted her. So the third part was this sexual assault case involving this 49-year-old wife of another officer on Camp Lejeune. So those three things went into this case, into this court-martial. They held the court-martial starting in late August. He pleaded not guilty to all charges, and over 2 very long weeks, they crammed it in on Labor Day and Saturdays and everything else. So they got
Hurricane was coming up. And we should say, by the way, when Rory uses the name Jerry Walsh, she gave us permission to use her name in print. So we're not using her name.
And that was the adult female, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so they deliberated on this case for about 8 hours. This member panel that was 4 generals and 3 colonels. And they came out with a mixed verdict. He was convicted of child sex abuse for the little girl. He was acquitted of all other child sex abuse related charges, including child rape. He was acquitted of all sexual assault charges involving Jerry Walsh, the adult female. and he was convicted on 6 of 8 conduct unbecoming charges, as well as an unauthorized absence charge. He was sentenced the next day to 5.5 years in prison.
And to bring the listeners up to speed, so that liaison position down in Darwin at the northern part of Australia, that was only created by the Marine Corps maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, definitely in the teens. And I believe that Colonel Wilson was the chief of staff over in Japan. And is that when he was sent down to Darwin?
Correct. Yeah, he was chief of staff for 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force after having previously served as the commanding officer of Weapons and Field Training Battalion down at Parris Island, South Carolina. And so, you know, as we know, we got the kind of the rotation that goes through Darwin now, where U.S. Marines and the Australian forces work together. And so I think that type of training was still in its infancy. So he was kind of one of the very first officers to go to Darwin. And what was it? He got kicked out like 13 days later, I believe. Yeah, 10 days later. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll tell you, that seems to have... I don't want to excuse any other of the, you know, convicted conduct, but it seems that that should have been a lot bigger red flag to people in his command. I mean, he's a senior, very senior chief of staff. That, I mean, for the non-military people in the audience, that is the right-hand man or woman of the commanding officer, of the commanding general. Your most trusted position, sometimes even senior in number of years to the general. And to get kicked out after 10 days with one of our, you know, most important strategic alliances, did you get any insight during the trial about that?
If I could just add before Rory goes in, just to kind of heighten how it wasn't even just Colonel Wilson being, you know, kind of this high-ranked, you know, senior Marine officer. He was also connected to a lot of individuals. I mean, for a while, me and Rory were expecting General Joseph Dunford, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right, to be at the court-martial. We were also expecting the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Robert Neller, to be, you know, at his court-martial. I mean, actually, throughout our reporting, you know, Colonel Wilson refers to the Commandant of the Marine Corps as Uncle Bob, you know, for Robert Neller. You know, when is Uncle Bob going to find out? You know, and there was actually one issue where it was after the initial charges came out, you know, that Colonel Wilson apparently wrote a letter to Uncle Bob expressing kind of how he's being treated by NCIS, and his lawyer wasn't too happy about him, you know, writing to the Commandant of the Marine Corps. And I reached out to the Commandant's office, and they apparently did not receive any letter from Colonel Wilson. So that's a little bit of a conflicting issue. And I'm not sure if the Commandant would have written back, because that might have been seen as, you know, unlawful command influence or something like that. But yeah, this wasn't just some random, your run-of-the-mill chief of staff. This was someone who kind of knew some very high players inside of D.C. So, yeah.
Now, what I want to add to this is that, first of all, I've seen press coming out of Australia recently questioning why it is that after this very unsuccessful 10 days in Darwin, he was moved back to Lejeune as Miller's chief of, was he his OPSA, his operations?
His operations officer, yeah.
And some of the journalism coming out of there is suggesting that Miller was pushed into an early retirement because of this lapse of judgment. Now, I've seen no reporting on that here or any way to confirm that. But it was clear at the court-martial that Philip Stackhouse, Wilson's lawyer, was not going to contest many of the conduct unbecoming allegations. They sort of cordoned those off, and they talked about his drinking problem, Wilson's drinking problem, and tried to keep that stuff separate from the sexual assault allegations, which I think they viewed much more dangerous to his future. But the question remains, why, when he failed so spectacularly in Darwin, why was he immediately moved back to Lejeune as the operations officer for Miller, the convening authority on that base?
Right, and that's something that I've addressed a number of times is, so Colonel Wilson is moved back. He works for General Miller, and then General Miller's the one that makes the decision about him being in pretrial confinement. And
Correct. If
you're looking at your operations officer, I mean, these are all the senior colonels that are on your staff. Those are people you're meeting with at least every other day and have close relationships with. You know, those are not just kind of random passers in the night. You know, those are, you know, probably your judge advocate, your staff judge advocate, your chief of staff, your OPSO, and a few other people. Those are the core of that commanding general's, you know, inner sanctum. And for that person to be making, it maybe didn't have the necessary distance from the situation before making that determination.
I think so. And then, you know, on July 15th, NCIS interviews Wilson over the sex assault charges, and he remains as OPSO, but he doesn't have any duties anymore. He doesn't even go into work or anything. And this is when, according to Wilson's wife, this is when he starts drinking and he heads downhill really fast. But he wasn't actually charged until November, so 4 more months. And then he stayed out of the brig for 2 more months until the Jerry Walsh allegations. So even though he was sort of sent home from work, he was still given a lot of respect and a lot of leeway and freedom at this time by Miller.
And then when does General Miller, when does he retire?
Just the last few months, I believe.
I want to say it was around the November timeframe, 2016.
Military Justice is brought to you by the good people of ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Do you know where to go to post your jobs to find the best candidates? Well, it's ZipRecruiter. In fact, just this past week, I was at a party talking to a longtime family friend and business owner, and I mentioned that I was just getting sponsored by ZipRecruiter, and she said that she used it and got great candidates through it. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus sites in one click. Then the powerful technology efficiently matches the right people to your job better than anybody else. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them. In fact, over 80% of the jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get qualified candidates in just 24 hours. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, the listeners of Military Justice can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. That's ZipRecruiter.com/military. One more time, to get it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/military. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. It allows this podcast to continue. I think this might be the interesting time to kind of bring in one of the stories within the story, because James, you were having some difficulty even reporting on this case. Is that right?
Yeah, and this is what led to my debarment, our barment, barred or debarment, whatever the correct.
I think that's like I think that's like flammable and inflammable. They both mean that it catches on fire.
Basically, I can't go on base. So what happened was during the course of this entire 10-month investigation, me and Rory found that there was a consensus among all the parties. And to my knowledge, we are the only journalist who interviewed every person involved in the story. But they agreed on 2 points, regardless if they were the accuser or the accusee. And that was, one, there was a huge distrust of the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. All parties felt that they would not do a thorough job in looking, you know, into this case. And both sides felt that way. You know, Jerry Walsh's side felt that way. The parents of the six-year-old felt that way. And Colonel Wilson and his wife Susan felt that way. The other thing was, all parties, for whatever reason, and I'm not sure what this reason is nobody trusted the public affairs office at Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune. I don't know why they didn't trust them. They just didn't. And so me as a journalist, you know, I'm trying to report this story and I'm trying to, you know, be unbiased and fair, but none of my sources trust public affairs. And, you know, this as a journalist or as a military reporter, to get the stories that you really want, you kind of have to go through public affairs. But
yeah, I think that's something that we should talk about for a second. Report like Rory, you reported for courts and police in Oakland previously, right?
Correct.
Yeah, like you could just go to that courthouse. For those that don't know, like military courthouses, and you know, by and large on almost every base, I'm sure there could be you know, small exceptions, but for the most part, they're in the heart of a base. So it's not like you can just walk up to them. There are armed guards and sentries, and it's not nearly as easy. And as we can see in this case, they can make it much more difficult to really report and have an open reporting about a court-martial.
First of all, I always had an escort, and I had to set up that escort. I needed to have a relationship with the PAO that, and they sort of kept asking whether I was credentialed and what, you know, if I was a staff writer somewhere. So being a freelancer, it was a little bit harder to create that kind of rapport with the PAO where they would include me on the information I needed, such as when opening statements were for this trial. And then there's the whole process of getting onto base, registering your car, getting an escort. The escort went with me everywhere. I mean, he stood outside the bathroom with me, went to lunch together and everything else. So there's a definite large presence. Like they went out of their way to make sure I could do the reporting there, but it wasn't easy. And there's a lot of barriers to entry that keep out, I think, your run-of-the-mill freelancer or even local news reporters who just felt like it was too much work to just get to the story, much less cover it.
Or even importantly, just a random member of the public, you know, that you can't really, that if you're just John Q. Citizen and you want to go see this trial, I mean, it's fairly, you know, you go through a metal detector, but you can go to any federal courthouse in the land. But, you know, having to register your car and do all the logistics of even getting into the seat is difficult in these type of cases.
Yeah, it really is. A certain amount of control over the proceedings, but that's always in conflict with this idea of transparency. So there's always problems, I think, that arise within this because they really want control more than they want transparency, but they want at least the impression of transparency, that the public can be a part of it. I found covering civilian court to be far more accessible and more transparent.
Yeah, that's been a definite problem for the military justice system. Even in the sense that if we're talking federal criminal court, you can just go on to PACER and get all the documents. You know, that is, the pleadings and documents are sometimes fairly hard to come by in a military case.
True.
Yeah, I was going to pretty much echo what Rory said, and also what, you know, I believe it was Craig Whitlock from the Washington Post told you. You know, I mean, there is the appearance of transparency. And that's merely what it is. There, I mean, you really, if you want to really cover a court martial, you really have to be diligent. You know, I mean, it was even to the point where there would be public affairs officers that I would call, and I remember this specifically, one instance where I called a public affairs officer regarding the Colonel Wilson case, and I asked, you know, hey, I'm just wondering if there is, and by this time I've been debarred, by the way, but I was asking, hey, is there any proceedings coming up, any, you know, 39A motion hearings coming up? This, information that they could have, you know, easily given me, but the answer I got back was, well, you can look that up yourself. And that was the end of the conversation.
Right, and it's not just like a normal courthouse where you could just go and look at, you know, the posted calendar for the week.
Right.
One big difference in Camp Lejeune Courthouse, which is, by the way, a very small ranch house-looking place that was just completely packed, the entire court-martial. But there you couldn't take in any recording equipment of any kind, so you had to lock up your cell phone in a box or leave it in your car. You couldn't bring in anything else that you could use to record in any way. So it was just notes. And when the records from a trial are tough to get or restricted, and all you have is whatever notes you could get down on paper, you know, it's hard to get a sort of definitive account of what happened in that court martial.
Right.
So, you know, we had these sources, and these sources just didn't trust the public affairs, and they didn't trust NCIS. And so me as a journalist, you know, my job is, especially dealing with accusations of sexual assault and victims of sexual assault, you know, my job is to make the source as comfortable as possible. You know, why would I want to, you know, the last thing I would want to do as a journalist is re-victimize someone, you know, and put them through the hell they've already been through, you know? And so my thought was, well, I'm not going to bring in people into these proceedings who they don't trust, you know, because then they're not going to trust me, you know?
Right.
And so then, you know, the question becomes, well, how'd you get on base? And it's not like I snuck on base or anything like that. I'm not like some James Bond or anything. I already had base access.
As a retired Marine, you still have base access.
Correct. Yeah, I still had base access. And so I simply just went on base. You know, I was invited over to the sources' houses. And that was it. I think the Marine Corps, in terms of the family of the six-year-old, the Marine Corps unfortunately tried to paint a picture that me and Rory were harassing them in some sort of way, that we were, you know, really just bombarding them with questions, and that was not the case at all. And the family would actually concur with what actually happened, which was, you know, they thanked us for what we were doing. They thanked us for, you know, covering the story because they didn't think anybody cared. And they really just, you know, they gave us their very first quote, you know, right after Colonel Wilson was convicted. So there wasn't this animosity between us and the family, but the Marine Corps did try to paint this picture of that we were somehow harassing them, you know, which was just not the case. And then the other thing they didn't like was that we later learned in terms of reporting this case is that for me and Rory, the Marine Corps kind of kept going back and forth on whether or not we were legitimate journalists. And it turns out that it seems like they only wanted to consider us legitimate journalists when it suited their narrative. So after Colonel Wilson is accused of his second sexual assault on the 49-year-old, Miss Jerry Walsh, he gets put into the brig. And so I went to the brig and I visited him. This wasn't an interview. This wasn't, you know, anything like that. I had already interviewed Colonel Wilson two times prior to that. So, I mean, I already had enough information in terms of his side of the story, you know, and there was there wasn't anything conflicting between his interview the first time and the second time. He was sticking to his story, you know. So I went to the brig to just simply check on him, you know, because anybody who is a source of a journalist, you also have a duty to kind of take care of them, you know, especially in a sensitive case like this. And people got to keep in mind that at this point in time, he is not convicted. So, you know, I'm not a rape apologist or I'm not anything like that. But at this time, he's not convicted. So I have to assume for all intents and purposes that he's innocent. But I check all of his, you know, anything he tells me and Rory are fact-checking, which, you know, it turned out to not go his way because there was just overwhelming, in terms of conduct unbecoming, there was just overwhelming evidence to support that he was not being a really good Marine officer. But that's kind of what the Marine Corps came down on me about, and it just happened to be bad optics for the Marine Corps, because it happened right after me and Rory had just finished reporting on the Marines United nude photo scandal going on in the Pentagon. You know,
I've done three episodes on that thus far.
That
is an ongoing issue, definitely.
Yeah, and Rory was with me through that entire reporting. He was reporting right along with me. But so when I got debarred, and then Representative Jackie Speier brings it up in Congress to, you know, Secretary Mattis and General Joseph Dunford, you know, people assume that I have been debarred from Camp Lejeune because of Marines United, which is not true. But it was really bad optics for the Marine Corps, who has not had a great year in terms of an organization or as an institution. If it's not all the sexual assault allegations and revenge porn, it's, you know, these training accidents. I mean, it's been a really rough year for the Marine Corps.
Well, and that seems like something that, to a certain extent, they bring on themselves, because if you're talking about this Colonel Wilson case or the Marines United case, there could be both, you know, alleged victims, alleged perpetrators that still have some nuance about how it's being investigated or how they're being portrayed. You know, there's always a story on each side, and to silence that, I think, only creates this vacuum that is just filled with speculation.
Right. And it actually got worse. Rory can tell you that there was like a concerted effort to delegitimize me and Rory as journalists. And Rory can tell you about that. It happened in court.
Okay. So this was near the end of the court martial. And Wilson's civilian lawyer, Phil Stackhouse, brought up the fact, it was true, that Jerry Walsh, the alleged victim, had done an interview with someone back in February of this case. And he brought it up because that was during the process of the court-martial where Stackhouse was sort of attacking the credibility of each of the witnesses for the prosecution. And one of the things he was showing is that Jerry Walsh had changed her story in subtle and not-so-subtle ways.
Sure.
When she to NCIS, when she talked to the court, and he wondered when she talked to us. So the fact was, she actually didn't change her story when she talked to us, but we had interviewed her. And actually, I had done a 3-hour interview with her, and I was sitting there in court as they talked about this James Laporta of the Washington Post, which is where they thought James was reporting this. So when this was brought up by Stackhouse, the prosecution began to ask some questions about it. And one of the prosecution lawyers made 3 separate false statements about James and me in our reporting. So the first one was that we had harassed the family of the 6-year-old, which was not the case. They had, you know, they wanted to talk to us, but decided that they would wait till after the court-martial because they were afraid of introducing contradictions into their testimony that could be used against them in court and to impeach their credibility. Second falsehood was that we were not real journalists. You know, we had 10 stories in the Daily Beast about Marines United in just a few months before this. So the fact that we weren't staff writers was sort of a way to minimize our role as journalists and sort of keep us out, I thought. The third mistake or falsehood that they introduced on this was, James, what was the third one?
That we were that we were working on behalf of Colonel Wilson.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So they said,
and yeah, so, that we were not journalists. We were like hired like hitmen or something. Yeah.
Like as though you were a PR firm or something.
Yeah. Like we had, yeah, exactly.
He had heard that James had a prior relationship with Colonel Wilson, which is true. He worked under him or somewhere under him at Paris Island. So the allegation was that were we really journalists at all, or were we basically posing as journalists in order to investigate the case on behalf of Wilson to supply his lawyer with material to impeach credibility of witnesses? So I had a little lapse in decorum myself. I was shaking my head, apparently fairly visibly in court at those allegations from the prosecution. And my public affairs escort proceeded to get chewed out by the leader of the prosecution for allowing me to gesture in court. And I was also warned that my behavior was inappropriate and unacceptable, and that there would be no more warnings if I shook my head again in court. And so I went through the head of the prosecution the next day and said, you know, I won't shake my head in court. I understand. But there's a reason that I was denying those statements, and that I felt that our reputation had really been besmirched by the prosecution in their efforts to sort of minimize our role in the case and, you know, keep us out, basically, of the future stuff.
Yeah, and that's an interesting idea. This idea, and I've run into it personally with FOIA requests, is this idea that there's somehow a bona fides reporter, and then there's, if you're not that, there's nobody else. And especially right. with the proliferation of types of media of reporting, that seems all the more odd. And the fact that this is, again, still supposed to be an open procedure for the general public.
Right. Yeah. And that tension was on display throughout this. I don't think that they have really adapted yet to this, the new media landscape where freelancers are far more prevalent. But I also think that they used that as a way to sort of keep journalists at arm's length. So even if they do know that the media landscape has changed, they were relying on these old rules to sort of keep control and limit access.
Yeah, and those are actually rules that I've really never been able to track down, because I had that in a FOIA request. I said, listen, I've had this many stories published, and I've, you know, published things on these outlets. You know, I want an exception from the FOIA rules, you know, having to pay for the FOIA requests. And yeah. it took going up a few rungs before there was this understanding that, listen, I don't need a card printed by the Washington Post or the New York Times in order to, you know, receive this. That is not the standard.
Right. And for James, this happened at one other point where they were saying, you know, in the process of sort of denying him information, and they were asking about his credentials, and he said, please show me where it says in your regulations anywhere that a journalist needs credentials in order to be treated as a member of the public, essentially, for these open proceedings. And he never got an answer from that, as far as I know, James.
No, and unfortunately, I was referred like up the chain, and the guy I was referred up the chain to, I continually just sent an email like twice a week asking for, you know, I kept asking for, can you please point me to a policy or a regulation or some sort of Department of Defense instruction that shows that you have to, what is credentialing, and this is how we define who a journalist is and who is not a journalist. The guy never got back to me, and he actually, I just saw he retired the other day from service. So I don't know if I'll ever get an answer, considering the guy just retired. but I thought that was – but yeah, I don't know. It seemed like they didn't mind knocking our credibility. And to be fair, we've worked with a lot of public affairs officers who have just been great. So this isn't every single public affairs officer. Let me just say that. But just in this particular case, it seemed like they didn't mind – kind of knocking our credibility down a little bit, and they seem to only use the term journalist when it suited their narrative. You know, it suited their narrative when I went to the brig, and that's what they also used for my debarment. You know, but apparently I was not a journalist any other time. You know, so I was a journalist when I went to the brig, but any other time before that, I was not a journalist. So,
to try to switch gears here for a second, and I think underline the importance of this without being too voyeuristic or anything. Rory, can you tell me about, you know, kind of underline, what was the child's testimony like? Kind of paint us a picture of that. I mean, you've done that in your stories, but I mean, that's really the focus of this prosecution. There were the other stuff about the conduct unbecoming and unprofessional, but that wasn't what contributed to a lengthy sentence. So kind of tell us about those days in court.
Yeah, I really think those were the most significant witnesses. It was the six-year-old girl. There were three kids, but there was one who was really the focus of all this, and her testimony on the first Friday of the court-martial was absolutely crucial. The other two witnesses that were crucial in that were her mother and father, both of whom testified. And there was fairly normal, though very contentious, testimony when the father, who's an officer, you know, testified, as well as his wife. But for the little girl, first of all, this started on the Thursday night before, and they had set up the courtroom so that what they called the central personnel, which was victim advocates, lawyers, the judge, and the parents of the little girl, were the only ones allowed to stay in the courtroom. Everyone else went across the sidewalk to an administrative building where they had set up a closed circuit TV feed. So at first, that's where we were watching this. But as soon as she began to testify, it became clear that she would, her voice was not strong enough to be picked up by the microphones. So they tried to bring in a new audio system, which continually malfunctioned. It had all this feedback. And I remember sitting across the way in this second courtroom, just biting on my reporter's notebook as I watched this little girl sit there for 20 minutes while all these men bustled around her trying to fix the technology. And her victim's advocate was trying to, like, keep her calm. And it really felt to me, when they finally called court off for the day because they couldn't fix the tech, it really felt extremely frustrating to me. For me, that was one of my most emotional moments. I called James getting out of there. And frankly, I was almost near tears because I have a six-year-old daughter myself. And watching this little girl have to be sort of re-victimized for this process and then actually not getting her testimony in so she would have to come back the next day and do the whole thing again.
Yeah.
Really deeply upset, and James had to sort of calm me down and remind me that I'm just the impartial observer. So the next day they got the technological problems worked out, and the next day again they separated the court, so half of us were over watching it on closed circuit TV, and the little girl testified. It was fairly quick, I would say about maybe an hour total with both the initial testimony and the cross, and there was no that was it. But it was fairly graphic. She had a victim's advocate with her. They had several other precautions set up in the courtroom to try to sort of minimize her victimization, but also encourage her to tell the truth. I thought that even Phil Stackhouse was very careful and very respectful with that. Also, the member panel was watching this whole thing. So everyone knew that you had to be extremely careful with the little girl testifying. She testified that Wilson, she was not clear about how many times it had happened or which instances. The prosecution alleged it had been four separate times from late June to mid-July 2016. The little girl just confirmed that at least on one of those times, Wilson had put his hands both above and down her pants over her vaginal area, and that it hurt, and that it was other descriptions of it that I won't want to get into, but essentially that he had digitally sexually assaulted. And he, there wasn't much that the defense could really do to impeach her credibility other than just say, you know, she's a 6-year-old girl and little kids don't tell the truth all the time because they can't remember it. And, you know, they essentially tried to show that she had been coached and that her mother had introduced words like touched into the conversation, and that she was basically trying to please her parents by making up this false narrative about molestation. But for me, watching it, I walked out of watching her testimony thinking a 6-year-old girl just brought down a full bird colonel. Because I didn't see how any human being, I didn't care if they were a colonel or a general, I didn't see how any human being could watch that without empathy and really a little bit of fury. And that had been, even that Wilson had put himself in a position where that was so inappropriate that something like this could even arise, much less whether it actually happened.
So during her testimony, could you see the members of the jury?
I could not.
But we're still talking about three generals and a number of colonels, right, that are sitting as the jury members.
Yeah, three colonels, three one-stars, and a two-star major general who was the jury president. They were pretty impassive, pretty tough to read.
Were they all male? But
they were all male. Oh. There were different. There were some different races in there. They were all male. And the PAO, the press, the public affairs, asked us not to name them in the story, so we didn't. But, you know, they were pretty public figures. I got the sense that these guys were not too impressed with Colonel Wilson's behavior, you know, because they had all been colonels or worse still. And it was clear that the little girl's testimony ended up being the crucial day, the crucial witness of this whole proceeding. And she was the one they believed. And they really didn't, I don't think they believed a lot of the other witnesses, including Jerry Walsh, but they did believe the little girl.
I think that what Rory was saying about the testimony from the girl, it plays into kind of how long the prosecution took to present their case and how long the defense took. Like the defense, I think, rested in 2 days? Yeah.
So, which I thought was interesting. That with the decision not to put Colonel Wilson on the stand and for Susan Wilson to claim spousal privilege to avoid testifying on the prosecution's behalf meant that it was a very flimsy case coming from the defense. What they really tried to do is impeach the credibility of every witness, but they didn't sort of create their own narrative or bring a bunch of witnesses to try to buttress that. It was sort of a reactive case for them.
So once we get the verdict back, as far as the findings of guilty and not guilty, different than other civilian jurisdictions, the military goes directly into its pre-sentencing case. So during that, who did the prosecution call?
I was not there that, I believe that was a Sunday night when the sentence came out. All I know is that they had one day worth of witnesses.
Okay.
And they were expected to have a couple more days. I remember talking to you and others. We sort of expected more witnesses on behalf of Wilson for sentencing, but it was whatever they crammed into that one day.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, I assumed maybe there would be more for Colonel Wilson just because, I mean, obviously I'm not in the same MOS. I've never served with him, but I knew a lot of people that knew him well, you know, that just kind of indicated that he had a pretty wide circle within the Marine Corps.
I got the sense that this judge, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Rubin, had very little patience for redundant witnesses or witnesses that were not germane to exactly what was being adjudicated at that time. So I know Susan Wilson had the sense that a lot of their witnesses were not being allowed. And I think that when Stackhouse said that he looked forward to a considerable appeal, part of his appeal is going to be that these witnesses were excluded from the proceedings by Rubin when he thought that they were relevant and should have been allowed to testify. So that may have happened during the sentence as well.
Well, gentlemen, I tell you, I don't like the subject matter, but I mean, it's an important service that you two do for the general public. Tell me what else, any other loose ends that you want to address about this case?
I think for me, personally, not talking as a journalist, on a personal level, you know, it was interesting to, I have two different pictures of Colonel Wilson now. I have, you know, kind of, you know, before 2016, and then I have the after, you know. And the before 2016, you know, the Marine in me used to sing his praises, you know, but, you know, after 2016, you know, while, you know, I was completely, you know, unbiased in this, I had to fight it every single day because it was almost like finding out that, you know, Jesus isn't Jesus, you know, or, you know, when Santa Claus isn't real, you know, there's this guy that I really looked up to and now it's, you know, now he's accused of this, you know? So that was the personal, on the professional side, I think it really shows the amount of effort that it takes to do an investigative piece well. You know, I think sometimes people don't understand, you know, why pieces take years, you know, 10 months or a year long project just to put out, you know, they see an article, you know, but there's a lot that goes into it and there's a lot of emotions. I mean, there were times where, you know, me and Rory thought we were going to have our notes subpoenaed. And we were trying to figure out, do we need to start talking to lawyers and hiring lawyers to defend our notes being subpoenaed in court? You know, there was at one point we created a list in terms of like, you know, we decided that, you know, if they tried to subpoena our notes and they tried to, you know, make us reveal sources, you know, we would push back and we were willing to go to jail. So we, you know, we created a list for, you know, our wives to, hey, call this person, this person, this person, let them know we're in jail, you know, and get some bail money ready. I think people don't realize that, you know, journalists are willing to go to jail for their sources. You know, journalists are willing to put themselves in the line of danger, you know, just to get the news to people. And, you know, I hope they do. I hope people realize that journalists we're not these people out here creating, you know, fake news and trying to, you know, derail people's careers and stuff like that. You know, we do it for the greater good. You know, journalists are, I don't know, maybe I'm getting off on a little bit of a rant, but I mean, journalists are just important to a democracy as guys who,
absolutely
guard the gates. You know, a republic is not just built on one thing, and journalists, you know, we're a big part of that. I mean, we're the only occupation that, you know, is named in the Constitution. So, I mean, that right there is enough evidence to show how important it is. But those are kind of my final thoughts.
Rory, what do you think? Okay.
Well, to me, one thing that was really interesting about this case was that there was very little physical evidence and no confession. So it was a case tried on circumstantial evidence that had to rely on witnesses who were inherently had credibility problems. In Jerry Walsh's case, it was that she had said different things at different times about the story. In the little girl's case, it was because she was a six-year-old. So that posed a lot of real challenges. Try to get to the bottom of this stuff. And, you know, there's a case in Wilmington right now. A guy just got convicted of kidnapping and sexually assaulting a little girl. And he was this, I hate to say run-of-the-mill, but sort of the stereotypical pedophile, a loser, you know, with a low IQ and a total inability to control his actions. And they convicted him in 3 days. And I looked at that case and just thought about how different it was from the Colonel Wilson case, where you had a guy who was really very competent individual, you know, who's done pretty amazing things. He has 2 master's degrees, one in, I think, counterintelligence and another in national security strategy, something like that. Like, this is a smart guy who knew how to get things done and deal with people. And what emerged over the course of the trial for me was that a huge factor here was alcohol. And I don't want to use it as some excuse for his behavior. And he's convicted of child molestation, essentially. And no alcoholism is an excuse for that. But it's also clear that alcohol was the common factor in all of this stuff as it went forward, from the conduct on Becoming in Darwin all the way up through some of his behavior when he was, but just before he was incarcerated at the Brig. So for me, it was just a fascinating case to cover. It took a personal toll on me that I didn't expect in terms of sort of anxiety and sleeplessness. And one of the things I'm most proud of is that James and I got through it and came out with a story that I felt was unbiased, factually accurate, and deep in terms of its coverage and understanding of what went on.
No, I definitely agree with that. And I think that I'll echo both of your sentiments. I mean, in this new – we're kind of getting used to this new media. And I think that on the negative side, you have it truncates the reporting because you have to eventually fit it down into 140 characters to tweet about it. And it's hard to capture, you know, a man who served his country for 30 years, did, you know, 11 deployments, who's also convicted of child molestation. But I think on the bright side, not only your reporting, but I really thank you for sharing your time on this longer format where we can really get into nuance and we're not just, you know, just, okay, you know, you have 38 seconds and that's all that's going to fit into this program. So I really appreciate you both being on. First, Rory, where can the listeners follow you? I'll also put this in the show notes, but where's the best place to follow you?
Well, I have a website, which is rorylaverty.com, but I'm at Rory Laverty, that's RORYLAVERTY on Twitter. Those two places would be the ones I would recommend.
Excellent. And James, you?
I'm jameslaporta.net, N-E-T, because .com was taken. And I'm at Jim Laporta on Twitter.
Excellent. I will put those all in the show notes. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Neethal Talhan, she takes care of everything. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my 6.